Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another DC Flashback Friday. We're talking about a few DC books from not so long ago, but maybe you haven't had a chance to read them. If you have, then great. We're going to go full spoilers here. If you haven't had a chance to read them, as I said, and you do plan on reading any of these books I'm going to talk about today, you may want to come back later after you've had a chance to check them out. So today I'm going to be talking about Damage number 15. Heroes in Crisis number 7 and Dial H for Hero number 1. So let's kick it off with Damage number 15, written by Robert Venditti. Aaron Lopresti handles the pencils. Matt Ryan does inks. Colors are by Hi-Fi and letters are by Tom Napolitano. And just a reminder, this was one of those books that was from the new age of heroes that DC was experimenting with, where they were doing the Marvel style. So, you know, I say written by Robert Venditti, but I mean, he's sort of writing an outline. It's not a full script where it's, hey, on this panel, this character says this, and then this character says this and what have you. It's Robert Venditti giving the outline of the story to Aaron Lopresti, and Lopresti is really doing the majority of the storytelling here. He's doing the heavy lifting where, he's deciding what goes in each panel. He's deciding how the story is going to play out narratively. And doing comics in this fashion, which people have come to call the Marvel method, or you know, working from an open script, or you know, whatever term they use, it really showcases the collaborative effort and how much the artists are storytellers in the same way that the writers are storytellers. I mean, so many times, just literally had this conversation, and I have this conversation all the time, but I just had it recently again, where we see, especially, and it's especially true when we see announcements for new series, right? Like, oh, coming up is Tom King's Plastic Man, or, you know, I'm just trying to think of examples. Oh, Peter J. Tomasi's Green Lantern, or whatever, you know, Grant Morrison's Batman. Those are the writers, right? Why are they getting all the credit for the storytelling when this is a visual medium? It's a collaborative process, and the story is told through sequential pictures. The artist is just as important. So to say Peter J. Tomasi's Green Lantern, you know, oh, it's coming up, I want to know who the artist is. That's just as important. Some might argue it's more important because guess what? If you have a comic book script and a comic book writer who's producing something and they don't have a collaborator, they don't have an artist, you don't have a comic book. So it's always frustrating to see when these announcements come out that there's not just as much billing given to the artist. I think the conversation that I had recently about this was in regards to the Supergirl announcement, new Supergirl series from Tom King. And in all the headlines and all the you know, social media posts and whatever, it was always Tom King, Supergirl. Well, who's drawing it? It's Bilquis Evely, who's an incredible artist. And I look forward to seeing what she does with Supergirl. Her name should be right up there along with Tom King's. And Tom would be the first one to tell you, it's not Tom King that's not giving credit where credit is due. So it's frustrating. You know, it's frustrating from the standpoint, if you're an artist producing something and you're not getting the credit you deserve, it's frustrating from a standpoint of myself, who always tries to, you know, talk just as much about the art. And I'm not an artist. I don't always have the right language and I don't always catch on, but I do my best. At least I'm trying. And so many reviewers, the artist, if he's even mentioned, is sometimes an afterthought. And that's not really okay. That's not what comics are. And so, you know, I just thought that it would be a perfect time to remind everybody, because this new age of heroes, the way that DC decided to do these books, giving the artists top billing because the artists were working from an open script in the Marvel method, it's a good reminder that, hey, these guys contribute just as much, in this case, sometimes more than the writer is, you know? So anyway, let's get into the story itself. If you remember a couple of issues ago, Damage was thrown onto Monster Island by Batman. after he didn't want to join the Justice League. And so we're introduced to a couple of the monsters here on the first page, the Beast of Belmora, captured by Mark Merlin, the Shaggy Man, captured by the Justice League, Death Dog, captured by Zatanna. These monsters are all chasing Ethan Avery, Elvis Ethan Avery. And the text tells us, hey, he was exiled here yesterday. Chances of him making it to tomorrow don't look so good. And he's running from these monsters and he's yelling out help. And he narrowly escapes after the seat of his pants is sort of torn out by one of the monsters snapping at him as he runs away. And we see the Congo Bill show up just as Ethan Avery is knocked off his feet by another monster called Ogro. And we're not even sure how he got here. And, you know, as I said, Avery's knocked off his feet. So he's kind of sitting on the ground and he's like, I don't suppose we could call time out. And as I said, then Congo Bill shows up. He tells all the monsters to back off and they kind of growl at him. And, you know, it's sort of that challenge of who's the alpha here. And Congo Bill's like, excuse me, you guys are turning on your game warden. And he kind of flashes his gorilla ring and he's like, how about I use my ring and we have a square go, you know, like you guys want to fight. And of course the monsters all kind of acquiesce and bow their heads and, you know, go stomping off into the jungle. And Congo Bill's like, oh, that was close, Avery. And he's like, and whose fault is that, Congo Bill? You're supposed to be like showing me the ropes here. You're supposed to be keeping me safe. And Congo's like, I did keep you safe. Like, what are you complaining about? I think you should thank me. And as he walks up to Avery, Avery punches him. And he's like, you left me in the middle of the jungle and left me for dinner. And Bill's like, well, you don't like running from the monsters? Now you know how people feel when you're damaged and you're out there wreaking havoc, right? I'm trying to teach you a lesson. And Avery doesn't want to hear it. He's like, you think I wanted to be damaged? I never asked for this. And I only let him come out when people are trying to control me and people won't leave me alone and let me live in peace. People like you. And he he dives at Congo Bill. Congo Bill punches him again. And Congo Bill says, Americans, right? Your country's only been around a couple centuries. And you think you invented the fight game. Well, that's not how it is. And he starts reaching for his ring. And Avery calls him out. Oh, yeah, there you go. Already reaching for your ring, right? You know I can't become damaged for another 23 hours. So you're going to turn into Congorilla anyway. Afraid to fight me man to man. And actually what Congo Bill is, he's reaching for his ring to take it off so he can put it in his pocket so he can go man to man with Avery. And he says, you know what? I want you to remember one thing. You asked for this. And the day I need the golden gorilla to take out a runt like you is the day I stop being Congo Bill. And he basically kicks Ethan Avery's butt, even though Ethan Avery's a, you know, a trained army soldier. He knocks him out and puts his ring back on and says, kids, I swear, man, it's easier taming monsters than teaching them. And he slings Avery over his shoulder and walks off. So meanwhile, on another part of the island, the monsters that were chasing Ethan Avery and weren't able to kind of satisfy their hunger by devouring him are kind of lashing out and tearing up the ground and what have you. And we see this figure in shadows saying, are you hungry, my lovelies? Well, don't fight amongst yourselves. You're monsters, but we're all a family here. Even if you've been forgotten and thrown onto this island. And, you know, it took me a long time to find this island, but, if they thought they could keep my children from me, they're wrong. And a mother knows. And once we get rid of Congo Bill, the world will be ours for the feasting. We won't be trapped on this island. So she says, never forget my lovelies, you're stronger together. And she starts weaving this spell and combines three of the monsters into one. Meanwhile, Congo Bill has taken Ethan Avery to the shore. He throws some water on him to wake him up and says, hey, why don't you take off those ripped clothes? And Batman dropped off some fresh ones for you. So as Ethan is changing, he's like, you know what? If Batman thinks this makes us even, I've got to show him otherwise. It's because I'm him. I'm stranded here with a bunch of monsters and a psycho Irishman. And Congo Bill's like, hey, first of all, I'm a Scot. And annoying know-it-all that he is, Bats never does anything without a plan. He gave me the job of game warden here, and he sent you here to me so I can teach you how to balance your human side and your monster side. Who better to teach you than a guy who's a giant ape half the time? And Avery says, you know what? I'm going to tell you the same thing I told him when they asked me to join the Justice League. No. You know, the army wanted to make me a super soldier, and instead they turned me into a monster, and I have to live with that. I don't have the choice, but I'm not going to be following orders. I'm not going to be under somebody's boot. So Colonel Jonas turned me into damage, and I'm not following her orders. I'm not following Batman's orders. I'm not following your orders. If I have to, I'll swim or I'll build a raft, but I'm getting off this island. Like, I'm done taking orders and having people tell me how to live my life. And Congo Bill's like, I wouldn't be so sure about that. And he whistles, and we see this giant monster pop up out of the surf. And his name is Schlog. He was captured by Aquaman. And Congo Bill says, yeah, Schlog patrols the shoreline, pretty much all of it. Aquaman made a deal with her, and as long as she does her job, she can swim free in these waters. Nobody's going to bother her. And everybody wins, except for maybe the whales, who we don't see much anymore. But anyway, hey, your 23 hours are up. You can turn into Damage anytime you want. And sure enough, Damage starts talking to Ethan and says, hey, give me an hour. We'll be the only thing left on this island. So again, Avery's still trying to get a handle on who Damage is. And so Congo Bill says, okay, so what's it going to be? Man or monster? Decision time. Choose the first, and you know, you do things one way, mine. If you want to be a man, I will teach you. And so Ethan agrees and says, I'll listen and learn what you have to teach me. And so Congo Bill's trying to explain to Ethan, you know, the Damage side of you, the monster side, it's always going to try to break loose, and it's easy to start depending on that and use it like a crutch. You know, a crutch that can punch a canyon in the ground, but a crutch nonetheless. So what you've got to do is you've got to learn how to figure out things on your own, right? Resist the temptation to use the monster. Grow your human side instead. And if you can learn to take care of most things as Ethan, as yourself, then you're going to be able to handle the guilt that comes with having to be forced to become Damage. And if he does something, knocks down a building or whatever, you know you didn't have a choice. And Ethan's like, wait, you understand about the guilt? And meanwhile, Damage is talking to him saying, don't listen to him, Ethan. You need me. You know, let me out. I'll show Congo Bill who's better. And Congo Bill's like, guilt? Yeah, I built a cage for myself. I took a job out here on Monster Island as the only person. There's nobody else around. You can't out-guilt me. And Ethan's telling Congo Bill, I can hear Damage in my head right now. And he thinks you don't know what you're talking about. He says I should turn him loose so he can shut you up. And Congo Bill's like, yeah, well, I've fought stronger and I've definitely fought bigger. He didn't say much after the Golden Gorilla knocked him cold a few days ago. But if he wants another lesson, you know, let him out. And as they're walking along, all of a sudden Congo Bill stops and says, hey, look down. What are you standing in? And Ethan is standing in this giant footprint. And he's like, yes, so what? It's a monster island. There's a giant footprint. So what? And Congo Bill's like, I don't recognize it. That's what. And Ethan's like, but there's tons of weird things on this island. What's one more? And Congo Bill says, they might seem weird to you, but I know and understand all of them. I've been here a long time, and I can identify every bird call, every track, every piece of scat. There's no monster on this island that I haven't seen. And this track wasn't left by any monster. It was left by a hybrid of them. And all of a sudden they hear some rustling in the trees, and we do see this terrifying monster, the result of that combination from that shadowy figure combining three of the monsters together. And it's huge, and it's scary, and it immediately starts threatening Congo Bill and Ethan. And Congo Bill observes right away, she's here. And Ethan's like, what are you talking about? Who's here? And before they can, before Congo Bill can answer, Ethan is knocked off his feet, and Congo Bill is knocked unconscious. And again, Damage is asking to be let out. It's my time. It's my time. And Ethan turns to Congo Bill, and he's like, Damage wants to handle this one. Do you think I should let him out? Bill doesn't answer. He's unconscious. So now it's up to Ethan. What is he going to do? Will he let Damage out? And turns out this monster can also breathe fire. It shoots some fire at Ethan. He jumps out of the way. Damage still clamoring to get out. And Ethan's like, shut up, just let me think. And Damage is like, yeah, good idea. Think. Remember what you used to be when you were nothing before you got me. And that kind of pisses Ethan off. It's like, no, Bill's right. If I only use you to fight my fights, then what's the point? And Damage is like, the point is you're not going to survive. You're worthless. You're weak. And you're going to get us both killed. And Ethan's like, you know what? Maybe. But if I die, I'm going to die a man. And he grabs a broken branch and actually attacks this monster and smacks it and says, come on, let's fight. But then he himself gets knocked out by the monster. He's thrown back against a tree. And Damage is trying to wake him up. I told you, Ethan, look what you've done. And we see a voice off panel saying, oh, Congo Bill found an apprentice, huh? Well, it's going to be really enjoyable watching what happens next to both of you. And as we turn the page, we find out who that shadowy figure is. It's the mother of monsters, Echidna. And she says, Monster Rock is my kingdom now, and I will rule again. And we see Congo Bill and Ethan Avery are both being taken off somewhere by this this hybrid monster, this chimera monster that she has created. And we get the blurb, next it all ends. So action-packed issue, really fast-paced. I am sort of disappointed that we didn't get more of Damage. This whole new age of heroes, a lot of people were talking about it being sort of the brainchild of Dan Didio and him sort of leaning into some of the classic archetypes from across the street at Marvel. And Dan himself admitted as much, right? His series Sideways is very much like a Spider-Man analog. This one clearly is the Hulk. But it's such an interesting dynamic. First of all, Damage can only be out 1 hour out of every 24. Ethan Avery, much like Bruce Banner, struggling to control the monster. And the fact that they can communicate. And there have been times where the Hulk persona and the Banner persona have communicated either through notes or a little more active the way Damage and Ethan Avery can communicate. But this is different enough, and it's interesting to me. And it seems like we were just getting to the point with Congo Bill here trying to teach Ethan Avery, hey, you got to learn to handle things on your own so you can deal with the guilt of being the monster. I mean, that's such an interesting thing to explore. And I know it's been explored over in the Hulk, as I said, but this is different enough that I was curious and I wanted more. But we know that none of the New Age of Heroes titles sold that well. But I do think along with Sideways, Damage was probably my favorite title. And I just wish that it lasted more than the 16 issues that we got. But all that being said, it is action packed. I think the whole series is worth reading. It's fantastic. The art is spectacular. And again, part of that is the method that they use, as I mentioned, using that Marvel method. I mean, they're Marvel analog, sort of, so why not use the Marvel method to try to tell these stories? And when you're talking about bringing Aaron Lopresti on to do the visual storytelling and kind of set up the pacing of the story in the way he lays everything out sequentially from a visual standpoint, you're talking about a really great, talented artist who's got some really good visual storytelling chops. He's awesome at action. He's very much suited for the kind of story that's being told here, especially when you're talking about giant monsters and fighting and all that. If I had any kind of nitpick at it, I don't know. It's hard to even say this is a nitpick, because the thing is, when you get big panels, you get to see the detail that Lopresti puts in his art. But this particular issue, it does have some large panels, which makes for a relatively quick read. And I kind of wish that it felt a little meatier in terms of story. But if you start talking about using smaller panels, then I'd very well maybe say going the other way around and going, I wish the panels were bigger so I could see more of the detail in Lopresti's art. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge for him to give us some great visual detail and also give us a big chunk of story. So I get that. So I don't know if it's really a complaint or not, to be honest with you. Maybe just goes back to my desire to just wish there was more Damage, you know. And if I can't have more issues, then give me more story in each, individual issue. So it's tough to say, but I love the choices that he makes. The panel where Ethan Avery, he makes that decision when he's being attacked by the hybrid monster and Congo Bill's knocked unconscious and Damage is like, let me out. You're not going to survive otherwise. You're going to get us killed. And and Avery picks up that chunk of wood off the ground and attacks the hybrid monster with it, you know, and he's saying probably, but if I die, I'll die a man. And he's leaping at the monster with this piece of lumber raised over his head, about to smack the monster. It's super, that image of Avery leaping at the monster holding this piece of wood is superimposed over a picture of damage. And it is just awesome. It is such an amazing image, you know, because it invokes everything that we get in the story, that we've got in this series all along, right? This idea of damage always lurking in the background, of the intensity of Ethan Avery, of him having that fight constantly on his hands, of damage trying to come out, him trying to decide who he is, not wanting to be controlled by anybody. You can see the angst in his face, and it's a triumphant image in a way that he has made his decision. Even if he's going to die here fighting this hybrid monster, at least he's going to die as a man. He's talked earlier in the issue about how he's not going to be under anybody's boot, right? He's not going to follow the orders of Colonel Jonas. He's not going to follow the orders of Batman. He's not going to follow the orders of Congo Bill. He just wants to be left alone to live his own life. And in that way, he has decided he's not going to be under the boot of Damage himself, right? His alter ego. He's not going to live his life with Damage controlling things either. He's going to live and die as a man. That's his choice. And it's all encapsulated in this beautiful image. It's absolutely amazing. I love it. So again, there's only one other issue of Damage. It ends at 16 issues, and haven't seen him in a couple of years since the story ended. I'm pretty sure Robert Venditti had more story to tell. So maybe someday, or if not Venditti, maybe somebody else can pick up or put, maybe Damage will join the Justice League. You know, I just would like more. I think he's an interesting character, and there's so much potential for growth and evolution for Ethan Avery. He's a young guy. He's still learning. Clearly he has a lot more to learn, which is what Congo Bill was trying to help him learn, and why Batman put him on the island in the first place, to have Congo Bill as a mentor. So there's a lot of potential there. And I think in the right hands, which I feel like Venditti is the right hands, but there's plenty of other great writers out there who might be able to do Ethan Avery and Damage justice as well. So hopefully someday he comes back. I guess we'll have to wait and see. All right, well, let's move on to Heroes in Crisis number 7. This is the very well-known, or infamous, if you want to use that word, story from Tom King that we've been covering in detail each particular issue. Hopefully this gives people insight into what Tom was trying to do. And I think with as time goes by, and we've talked to Tom about this, we've had him on the show to talk about it. As time goes by, I think that, at least for me, the story gets better and better. And I know people have some problems with it, especially what it does to Wally West. And I kind of wish that they had made, DC Editorial, Tom King, whoever, had made a choice to use somebody different, only because the impact of Wally West on the DC universe that happened, or that became so self-evident in the DC Rebirth movement, or publishing initiative, or whatever you want to call it, that was so close relatively to this. You know, Wally had been gone for so long, and then he finally came back, and it was an emotional moment, and a lot of people, you know, really loved DC Rebirth when it first started, and we've talked at length about why it didn't work and how it lost momentum and what have you. But you know, Wally had been through the ringer. He hadn't even been around for a long time. So to finally give DC fans what they wanted, I think it would have been better. The story would have been better served to use somebody else and kind of leave Wally alone, only because, yeah, he just had a chance to come back. But at the same time, how does the story itself work if you don't use Wally? Because part of the reason that it does work is because Wally has come back, but he's no longer married to Linda Park. He no longer has his children. That's at the heart of his trauma. So in a way, he kind of had to use Wally. And I'm sure Tom could have figured out a different way to make it work with somebody else, and maybe that would have been better, maybe not. But regardless, he chose Wally West. And I think this story does work. And as I said, the longer period of time we're removed from this coming out and people having the knee-jerk reactions, the better I hope that people appreciate it for what it is and what it tried to do. But unfortunately, I think a lot of people haven't bothered to go back and read it with some perspective, and they just judge it for, oh, that's the story that ruined Wally, or what have you. But there are important things to be said about trauma and about kind of psychological damage and the toll that violence takes on us as humans, as people. In fact, in a previous episode where we were covering Heroes in Crisis, when Jay was on, he talked about how, you know, as a soldier that has, you know, fought overseas and whatnot, that he saw some similarities in some of these heroes at Sanctuary, some of the things that they were saying about trauma and damage and the feelings and the emotions that they were having and having a tough time coming back the soldiers coming back to the U.S. and having trouble adjusting, and some of the things the heroes at Sanctuary were saying about being in their civilian identities and having trouble adjusting and letting the violence go and whatnot. So again, these are important lessons, and this is inspired by Tom King's own, you know, career and being in the CIA and being overseas fighting against terrorism and some of the things that he saw firsthand. So this is something, again, that I think is worth exploring. The problem being, like I said, choosing Wally West, choosing these beloved heroes, maybe people just weren't ready for it. It would have been interesting if Tom had done this as a creator-owned with characters that people didn't really know. But then I think, well, you do that and then it kind of loses impact. I mean, part of the reason this does resonate so much and does have impact is you're seeing characters you've known for decades, like Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, and they're giving their confessionals. And we're seeing how they, the Holy Trinity of the DC Universe established the Sanctuary in the first place as sort of the leaders of the superhuman community in DC. They established this Sanctuary in the first place to try to help the other heroes and themselves because they do know that it's a problem. So if Tom had done it creator-owned in a different universe, then you don't have that impact, right? You can try to create analogs for the big three here at DC, but it's not going to have the same impact because they don't have the same history. They're not as well known. So I think this story works, and I hope that people go back and revisit it and see it for what it is rather than just complaining that, oh man, DC and Tom King and Dan Didio, they all hate Wally West. That's just not the case. So anyway, as I said, written by Tom King, we have three artists in this particular issue: Clay Mann, Travis Moore, and Jorge Fornes. The colors are by Tameo More, letters by Clayton Cowles. So on the cover, which the main cover is by Mitch Gerrits, we see Superman separating Booster and Harley, and he's yelling, "Enough!" We know that the events that sort of set off this whole investigation and the death of Wally and Roy Harper and everybody else at Sanctuary, it was Booster that thought that Harley had done it. It was Harley that thought Booster had done it. And Superman is there separating the two of them, telling him, "Hey, stop fighting. Stop trying to blame one another," or what have you. So the story starts off and we're looking at some flowers on the ground, and Wally is thinking about how at their wedding, Linda had read a poem, and sometimes he goes back there to watch, and she's so beautiful, and he starts reciting the poem. And as we turn to the title page, we see Heroes in Crisis is written in flowers, and it's an incredible scene. I can only imagine how long it took Clay Mann to draw this. And the other thing that I should say is while he's touching these flowers, there is a rose that looks like it's seen better days. You know, it could be dying. It looks a little worse for the wear. And then we see Wally sort of infuse it with some energy from his hands. And then we see the rose as it looks newly bloomed. And when we look at this title page that says Heroes in Crisis, that rose stands out. It looks more vibrant than any of the rest of the flowers. And then we, as we turn the page, we move on to Harley Quinn fighting against Booster. As I said, the front cover, which is actually more of a flashback, but this is happening in real time. We know that Booster and Blue Beetle had gone to Flash's lab. They had managed to knock out the Flash, and they were going to try to see what evidence the Flash had found from studying the crime scene at Sanctuary. Harley and Batgirl had tracked them down there. Harley still believes that Booster's the one who killed everybody at Sanctuary. So she's trying to take out Booster, trying to kill him, really. And Batgirl is trying to prevent that, but she wants to get to the bottom of it too. So as Harley's attacking Booster, she's talking in rhyme, sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye. Harley's going to kill you. You're going to die. And Blue Beetle's trying to talk to Harley. He's like, Harley, we're trying to figure out what happened. She doesn't want to listen, of course. And Batgirl's like, no, Harley, we're not going to kill anybody. And then she says to Blue Beetle, I told her like seven times. And Butcher's like, or Blue Beetle's like, don't worry, he's got a shield, he'll be fine. And Batgirl's like, I'm just saying, this was not the plan. I want you to know, this was not the plan. Meanwhile, Harley she had swung her mallet at Booster, and the hammer part broke off. Now she's trying to stab him with the stick that's left. Continuing the rhyming, when Harley kills you, you're going to scream. It'll be so very fine, better than peaches and cream. And again, Booster's force field protects him as she tries to stab him with this piece of sharpened wood. And Batgirl's like, you know, I'm just not used to working like this. I usually work with Batman. And Blue Beetle's like, well, I usually work with Booster. And Batgirl's like, oh, so you get it. And he says, oh, yeah, I get it. I totally get it. On the next page, we get a confessional from Wally. And it's his first day at Sanctuary. He's admitted he has a problem. He's like, that's the first step, right? Like, I'm here. And I heard about you. I heard about Sanctuary. But I'm not sure how things are supposed to work here. So should I tell you what the problem is again? Or because I'm all in. Whatever I need to talk about. I can start at the beginning. I can start at the end. I just, you know, I know what's wrong with me and I'm here. And that's good, right? Like, that's the first step. So meanwhile, at the Batcave, Batman's still investigating, trying to figure out what's going on. And Flash is running around trying to find Booster. And he's talking real fast. And Batman is just kind of like, yeah, Booster. Uh-huh. Yeah, he's just, you know, very stoic, as Batman tends to be. So meanwhile, Harley and Booster are continuing to fight. And they're both yelling at each other, I saw you kill everybody. No, I saw you kill everybody. And Batgirl and Blue Beetle are just kind of standing there watching. And Batgirl says, you know, he's protecting himself with that shield. And I thought Harley said it was broken. And Blue Beetle's like, yeah, it was, but I fixed it. He's like, really? Because I wouldn't think you'd be able to replace a 25th century power source. Blue Beetle's like, yeah, right. I didn't really have time for that. So right now it's just operating off of my ship. The bug. And she's like, well, wait, isn't the bug like tied into your consciousness? And he's like, yeah, pretty smart, right? I think it worked really well. And you know, it's something just short term. Like, yeah, that's great. But don't you have to like be conscious for that to work? And Beetle's like, yeah, it's one problem, but you know, we'll figure it out. But for now, this will work until we can get a permanent fix. And Batgirl's like, huh. And she's kind of thinking. And then out of the blue, she just clocks Blue Beetle and knocks him out. And starts walking over to Harley and going, okay, look, his shield's gone, Harley. But remember, no killing. I'm serious. And and Booster's like, uh-oh. Like, he realizes that his shield is gone. And Harley winds up for a big punch. And once more with the rhyme, Harley had a little Booster. His brain was made of lead. And for all the things that Booster did, Harley made him dead. And Batgirl, like, hey, Harley, didn't I just say no killing? God, for the eighth time, come on. And so then we get another sort of interlude here with Wally giving a confession. And it's week one is over. And he's talking about having gone through the first week and it being good. And he feels like progress is being made. He's talking about all the stuff that is causing him trauma. Losing Linda, losing Iris, losing Jay, the fact that they're all gone. And it almost seems like he's trying to convince himself here when we see him and kind of his expression as he's recounting things. Then we get another quick glimpse in the Batcave, And Batman saying, ever since the breakout, I've monitored every safe house, including the ones that the League is not supposed to know about, and all the communication at Cord Industries and all his subsidiaries. We gotta find him. And meanwhile, Flash is running around, like, literally searching continents. And he shows up. He's like, not in Africa. Like, okay, well, if they're not using any of Beetle's resources and they have to fall back on Michael's, I have contacted Rip Hunter. And it turns out that Rip already had quite a few watch lists on Michael in this area, just, you know, from things he's done in the past. And none of those warning systems have been triggered. So knowing them and who they are, they're going to make a mistake. We just need to have patience. And Flash shows up, not in Europe. And Batman turns around and goes, look, Barry, if you insist on doing this, you don't have to stop here. You could use the Bat radio, you know, and you don't have to keep coming back to the Bat Cave. And Flash says, I'm faster than the Bat radio. And Batman starts to tell him, well, I'm not sure that's actually true, but I suppose under specific conditions. And meanwhile, before he can even finish that sentence, Wally leaves and comes, or Barry rather, leaves and comes back and says, not in Australia. So in the time that Batman has been having this one-sided conversation, Flash has managed to search three continents, Africa, Europe, and Australia. So meanwhile, back at Barry's laboratory, Booster's like, fine, go ahead, do it, kill me, I'm not worth it. I did it, I'm admitting it, I'm a failure. I failed the future, I failed the past. Screw it, you know, F everybody and everything. And this actually gets to Harley. She's like, okay, I'm going to do it. And she picks up that chunk of wood again and drops another rhyme. Hickory dickory dock, Harley went for a walk. She saw her love covered in blood, hickory dickory dock. Because remember, Poison Ivy was killed as well. And that's what is driving Harley to kill Booster, who she thinks is responsible. But as she picks up the wood and goes to stab Booster and have her revenge, she actually stabs the ground next to him, and then kind of has a little fit, starts yelling, damn it, damn it, damn it, and ends up laying down next to Booster and you know, realizes that she has changed too, and maybe through Sanctuary, maybe through her relationship with Ivy. And so they're laying there next to each other, and Booster says, you know, can I ask you what's with all the rhyming? And Harley says, well, I don't know. That's what superheroes do, right? When they're superheroing, they talk while they fight. And this is kind of the best I can do. I'm really not very good at superheroing, right? I mean, Harley is up to this point, has started to change. She started to turn over a new leaf that started really even before the Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor run. Maybe the first Harley Quinn series or the Gotham City Sirens, where she's, you know, breaking away from the Joker and trying to be more of a hero. But this is another step along that journey. She sees herself hunting down Booster as a good thing, right? Booster killed everybody. He's a murderer. He needs to die. She's on the side of angels here. Maybe not quite all the way on the side of angels, because she, you know, has been saying all along she's going to kill Booster. But when the time came, she did refrain from doing that. But she realizes, as I said, she's not very good at superheroing, in her own words. And Booster's response to that says, yeah, me neither. So it's kind of like a now what situation, right? So Flash's meanwhile has, you know, we flash back in the confessional. Wally West Flash is in the confessional once again, saying, second week's done. What do we learn? Well, I've learned that ever since I was a teenager, I've been a superhero, right? Struck by lightning, dodging bullets, and I looked up to my Uncle Barry, who then died running too fast to save the world, like, you know, we saw in Crisis on Infinite Earths 8. And as soon as I accepted that he was gone and I was alone and could go on alone and finally felt healthy, then Barry came back. And in the meantime, I had this whole family that I loved, and I keep talking about that. But then there was another crisis, which was caused by Barry, that being Flashpoint. And then everybody I loved and knew was gone. And now I'm back and everybody wants me to be this symbol of hope. But how can they expect him to be a symbol of hope when he's so broken, he can't get past the loss that he suffered. No Linda Park wife, no son and daughter. And again, it just feels like Wally, as he's saying this confession, he's trying to convince himself. He says, oh, what a week. Week two, we're really getting somewhere. Are they really? So anyway, back to the very beginning, very first couple pages of the book with all the flowers, we see that rose once again that Wally had infused with some of his powers. And he's talking about, again, Linda reading that poem at his wedding. And he loved the way Linda read it. And Narc tried to explain that poem to him once. It's about creating things and making things, but not literal things, but like how love makes things. Sometimes literal things, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, everything grows out of love, or out of love, everything grows. And we see as he's doing this flower he's imbued with this energy, poison ivy starts growing up out of it. So clearly he's manipulating time to bring ivy back. So meanwhile, Blue Beetle has regained consciousness in Barry's lab, and the four heroes are sitting there talking, and Harley's saying, wait, Wally's alive? And Booster's like, yeah, well, what we discovered was his body that was at Sanctuary, the dead body that was found there, was 5 days older than it should have been. So yes, he's still alive, because he lived, you know, for at least 5 days after the events at Sanctuary. And Batgirl's like, but today is 5 days since you guys last saw him. So is he still alive? And Blue Beetle's like, yeah, right. Yeah, so he's not alive. And Harley's like, but maybe he is, right? Maybe we still have some hours. Maybe he's not dead yet. We should find him. Maybe we're supposed to kill him and put him back in the past. And Batgirl's like, okay, we're not supposed to kill him. We're not supposed to kill anybody. But you are right. We should look for him. Maybe we can rescue him. Maybe we can stop him from dying and then having his dead body be taken back to the past. If somebody's pulling him back in time, there's got to be a way to detect that. And Booster says, well, you guys have Skeets, right? He's really good at that kind of thing, finding time disturbances. He'd tell me that about himself all the time. But in order to do that, in order for him to search everywhere, we're going to need like a really big signal boost. And Cord's like, well, we could use the Cord satellites. It creates a web around everything. So Batgirl, you hook Skeets up to the network, and that could do it, right? And shouldn't we tell the Justice League or Batman or somebody? And Batgirl says, I think it's better to go small, because Wally might be hurting and Wally might need our help. Small's better. And Booster's like, yeah, besides, they'll get all crazy and they think we're crazy, and we're not all crazy. And Harley's like, yeah, I'm all crazy. Is that a problem? Or like, and Booster stands up and says, oh, that's a good thing, right? Everybody thinks that we're not very good at superheroing. We even think that. And that's why they think that we did it, that we had the capability to do this. But maybe they're wrong. And maybe we're wrong to think that we're bad at superheroing. So maybe we're the something that can fix this. Maybe we're Blue and Gold, and you know, that being the nickname for Blue Beetle and Booster Gold. And Harley reverts back to what she called Batgirl and herself earlier, the dynamicer duo. And Batgirl's like, no, like, God, please don't call us that. And Booster says, yeah, Blue and Gold and the dynamicer duo, competent, righteous superheroes on a secret mission to save the world. And you got to admire Booster, even when he's down. You can't keep him down for long. He's always going to look on the bright side of things. So meanwhile, back at the Batcave, now that Cord has started to use his satellites to try to track down this time disturbance, Batman says, there we have it. The alarms are triggered. And Flash is sitting there in a chair resting. He's like, which alarms? And Batman says, all of them. So meanwhile, back in the Field of Flowers, we see that Poison Ivy is back. Wally has managed to pull her essence and grow it from this flower. And he's there kneeling next to her apologizing. And Poison Ivy says, well, you helped me. Why are you sorry? And Wally says, I didn't help you. I hurt you. And then I did this. I brought you back, but this bringing you back doesn't make up for hurting you in the first place. And it doesn't make up for what I did. You just woke up, you have life, and I'm sorry that you're gonna have to see this. And Ivy's like, I don't understand, what will I see? And Wally stands up and he says, death, you'll see my death. And we see another Wally West show up, and they're standing there facing each other. So we finish up with the last page. Once again, Wally in the confessional, and week three is done. And he said, wow, I didn't even think this would take 3 weeks, but here we are. He thought he would be over his trauma. And then he actually goes silent for a while. And for the first time, we see him unable to put on a brave face, unable to pretend that things are better. And at one point, he's got his head in his hands, and then tries his best to put on that brave face, and holds up four fingers and says, can't wait for week four. So this clearly isn't working for Wally. It's too much. His love of Linda Park, his marriage to Linda Park, his kids are so much a part of who he is, and he's broken. And as much as Sanctuary can help to try to get over some of these things, when you're missing a part of yourself the way Wally is, that pain can just be overwhelming, especially when it's almost like he's, in a way, he's in denial. At least for the first 3 weeks, he keeps talking about, this is working. I've admitted I have a problem. I've admitted there's something wrong. I'm missing my wife and children, and you know, I need to be here at Sanctuary. But he's going through the motions, but he's not doing the work necessarily as much as he's trying to. And again, it might be just because the trauma is too much to overcome. So still trying to put on the brave face, though, still trying to be the hero. So issue 8, which we'll talk about next time, really does sort of explain everything that happens. It kind of closes the loop, as it were. And again, I just think this series, it gets a bad rap. There's a lot to it. And the art is really spectacular, especially in this issue, the Clay Mann pages, the pages with the flowers are done really, really well, as are the confessionals, which Clay Mann does a really good job on throughout, showing us emotion through body language and facial expressions and whatnot. Jorge Fornes, I mentioned, handles art in this issue as well, doing the pages in the Batcave with Batman and Flash, which are pretty fun and add a little bit of levity to it. And the Travis Moore pages, you know, again, also handled really, really well. The sequences that Travis does, I think they add a lot to the story. He kind of handles the scenes in the laboratory of Barry Allen, and there's a lot of really great facial expressions there, and great action with the Booster and the Harley fight. So really great art throughout, and Tomeo More is just a master colorist, does a great job bringing it all to life with good looking colors. So let's move on to the last book I'm going to talk about. It's the first issue of the Dial H, the latest version of the Dial H sort of property from DC. It's written by Sam Humphries, art and cover by Joe Quinones, letters by Dave Sharp. And so not only does Joe Quinones do all the line work, but he also handles all the colors. So incredible job by him. So on the cover, we get our first look at Miguel Montez, the new possessor of the Dial. And for those not familiar with Dial H for Hero as a concept, it's a phone dial, like the old rotary phones, which some of you may not even know what a rotary phone was, but it's a circular sort of dial that you used to see on phones, and around the edge of the circle were numbers. And that's how you would dial a phone number. You would put your finger inside the dial the hole that corresponded to a particular number, and you would turn the dial till you got to a certain point, and you'd let it go. And then based on the distance, the dial would roll back, would tell the system what number that was, like how many clicks, each number of clicks corresponded to a number. And so then you would, you know, you'd go whatever, 6, and then a 7, and then a 2, and then a 1, and then a 0, and then a 7, and then a 5, or whatever it was. And then that's how it would connect. And so Also, along with those numbers, just like on a regular phone now, even a cell phone, above each of the numbers are some letters. So you can actually spell things out. Like somebody tells you to dial 1-800 the walk or whatever, you spell something out. You can spell out hero by dialing the number that corresponds with an H and then the number that corresponds with an E and an R and an O and so forth. And when you did that, you would gain superpowers. The dial, the mystical dial, the magical dial would give you powers, and you would turn into a different superhero each time you did it. And so that's kind of the concept. So this story starts off and it says, "Dear Superman, when I was 10 years old, the coolest thing happened to me. I almost died." And this is Miguel, and he's telling us about when he was a kid, he was trying to do a backflip off the high dive and he hit his head and he blacked out and sank like a stone. They fished him out of the pool and his parents were there and they're crying. His head was bleeding and his vision got dark and he thought, "Oh, that's it. I'm done for." And that's not the cool part, right? Because I mean, he's talking about the coolest thing that ever happened to him, because he almost died when he was 10. But the actual cool part was that Superman showed up. He said, "I happened to be flying by and I heard shouting," and he flew Miguel to the hospital. And along the way, he tells Miguel, "Hey, I took a quick look at your skull with my X-ray vision. Everything seems fine, but I'm taking you to the hospital just in case." And sure enough, everything was fine. But it made such an impression on Miguel that as he grew up, and kids, when they're young, they have this sense of invulnerability and invincibility and immortality. And that was such a rush for Miguel that even at a dangerous time or time when he hurt himself, to be able to spend that time with Superman and to have that rush of, being flown by Superman, he spent the rest of his childhood as he was growing up trying to recapture the feel of that rush, even to the point of doing things and risking things and making choices that were perhaps even more dangerous than the average person, like rock climbing or backyard wrestling or skateboarding or whatever. But no matter what he tried, he real life just couldn't compare to that day with Superman. And then his parents unfortunately were in a terrible accident. And he says, "And then the day my parents," well, that part too. But here's the thing: when you said I was going to be okay, is this really what you meant? And now that we're caught up to present time, we see that Miguel is working in a food truck called Mayo Madness, and he's helping somebody by saying, "Hello, welcome to Mayo Madness. How mayo I help you?" And he thinks, "Man, every time I go to work, I want to die. It's this revolting food truck in a nothing town called Devil's Canyon, California." And he's telling this guy, this customer at the food truck, saying, "We got mayo sandwiches, mayo fries, mayo soup, fried mayo on a stick, mayo surprise, and no, I'm not allowed to tell you what's in the mayo surprise." And the customer says, "Do you have anything that's not mayo?" And Miguel says, "You know what? You could literally try any other food truck." And he goes to take out the trash from the truck, and he sees one of his classmates from school, and she says, "It says mayo fries. What is that?" Miguel says, "Well, they're fries made out of mayo." She says, "Yeah, that's disgusting." And Miguel doesn't really want to hear it. It's not his fault. He hates his job. You're like, "Talk to my uncle. It's his truck." And the girl says, "Well, how fast does that truck go?" And Miguel's like, "Wait, do I know you? You're that girl Summer from my school, right? You're the one who always keeps running away." And Summer's like, I didn't know I was famous. People actually know who I am." And Miguel's like, "Oh, so you do it for attention?" And she says, "No, I do it because I feel like I'm the only one with the guts enough to try to get out of this stupid town. But anyway, you have anything to eat that isn't mayo? Because I'm trying to avoid going home until everybody else is asleep." And Miguel, kind of showing right away, we get an idea of what sort of person Miguel is. He's like, "I hate mayonnaise too, and I made a sandwich for later, but here, you might need it more than I do." And he tosses the sandwich to Summer, and she says, "Thanks, I owe you one." So meanwhile, Miguel's uncle starts yelling at him, like, "What are you doing out here talking to this girl? I told you to clean out the damn mayo traps again and again with you." And Miguel's like, "God, I gotta go. That's my uncle." And Summer's like, "Oh, the mayo mayor himself, huh? Have fun." And Miguel heads back toward the truck, and his uncle continues to berate him. "God, you're so lazy. how could I ever have taken you in? And Miguel's like, you said that I could go to the canyon and you know, be with my friends. And his uncle's like, I don't care. Take care of those Mayo traps. And what I said was, I'd take you in after your parents and everything, but I'm not going to harbor a freeloader. Shut up and do what I tell you. So it's clear that Miguel's uncle Bran is just not a nice guy. Slave labor here, if you will. So later, Miguel finally does make it out to the canyon, where his friends have built this this ramp to jump their bikes, basically. Miguel's thinking, man, I'm trapped in this town, in this canyon, in this life. I miss my mom and dad. And once again, he's still willing to take a risk that nobody else is. And as he's up at the top of the ramp and he's looking down and as it, you know, leads off into empty space to jump over this canyon, he even recognizes, man, this ramp is the definition of sketchy. But all my friends are looking at me and the peer pressure, and he's thinking, no fear. And he starts pedaling his bike, and he's thinking, I wonder if Superman hated it where he grew up, right? Did he ever feel like he was going to explode? Like there was just too much inside of him. He was meant for something more. There was a time when Superman wanted to fly away but couldn't. And as Miguel is thinking all this, he's going down the ramp, but unfortunately it very much is sketchy, and it kind of comes apart on him as he's riding his bike, and he's thrown over the edge. And he's falling down into the canyon, which is pretty high up, a couple hundred feet at least, it seems. And so as he starts to fall, he's wondering, did Superman ever push it too far? Because maybe I definitely did. And as he's falling, all of a sudden there's some crackling and lightning, and a phone, a rotary phone, like I was describing earlier, shows up next to him. And Miguel's like, what the hell's going on? And as the phone starts falling next to Miguel, the receiver comes off the hook, and he hears a voice coming over the line saying, Miguel, listen to me. If you want to live, you must dial H. And Miguel's like, what are you talking about? Who's this? And the voice says, do it, Miguel, dial H for hero. And so he grabs the phone, he dials the H, and all of a sudden he starts seeing this vision. And he's like, wait, what? And the voice says, hang on, Miguel. And all of a sudden a phone booth appears around him, and he's like, oh my God, you got to get me out of this thing. What am I in a phone booth? And then he remembers back to the poster he had in his room, where it was a poster of Superman changing in a phone booth. And as he's in this phone booth, it falls, and it, instead of crashing to the ground, it sort of goes through a portal. And then on the next page, we see a bunch of heroes and different characters from the DC universe. And they're all sensing that the dial has been used again for the first time in a long time. And they all have a little four on their forehead, which the number four is the number on a rotary phone that corresponds with the letter H. So we see Robin, we see Lobo, we see Snapper Carr, we see Angel and Beast, we see Harley Quinn. And finally, we see Alfred, who's on the phone with Batman saying, sir, you said to let you know as soon as I felt it again. And I've felt it. The H dial is back. So meanwhile, back at the canyon, we see a bunch of energy exploding up into the night sky from the bottom of the canyon. And Miguel is in this weird sort of psychedelic dimension, a lot of pinks and purples. And he's kind of floating there. And he's remembering that this feels like it felt when he jumped off the diving board, falling through the sky. His ears are ringing, but he can hear a voice. And the voice is saying, Miguel, welcome. If you wish to escape, if you wish to be magnificent, if you wish to discover yourself, all you have to do is dial. And he sees a giant dial show up. And as he's overcome with light, he says, I am, I am, I am. And we turn the page, I am Monster Truck. And we see that Joe Quinones, and he does this throughout the series, when Miguel becomes a new hero, because remember, each time he dials H, he becomes a new kind of hero. Quinones, incredible artist, perfect artist, maybe the only artist other than Patrick Gleason who could have drawn the series. He changes his style. He changes his style to suit what type of hero he becomes. And being that he became Monster Truck, this is a very 90s like cross between, I don't know, Marvel UK, milestone in terms of colors, maybe a little bit of Image thrown in with the headgear and the white eyes. But Miguel has become this hero called Monster Truck, and we get a little bit of background on him on this splash page. The H-Styles initiated, a new hero is born, but who is Monster Truck? Turn the page for his thrilling origin. And although he's a hero, he's Monster Truck. He's got a lot of sort of truck paraphernalia or iconography. Like, his shoulder pads are parts of a tire. On his back is a big engine. He's got like some tailpipes or exhaust pipes coming out from his belt that swoop off behind him. He's got little tires on his ankles. He's got tires on for knee pads. He's got little spoilers that come off the back of his feet. And when you turn the page, it's kind of leaning into this trope of who this very 90s inspired monster truck would be. His sort of saying as he leaps into battle, his battle cry is "pedal to the metal." And we see these other trucks drive up and say, "Behold, human, we are the immortal truck force. For 1,000 years, the earth needed a new eternal champion of trucking. And we have selected you." And we get another look as Monster Truck flies up into the air and he says, "Truck, yeah." And, you know, we're talking about Miguel being transformed into this never before seen champion. And he's a superhero, and he's got diesel in his veins and rumble in his mufflers, and his mud flaps are made to soar. And he sees himself in this junkyard, and he's crashing around on all these cars and talking about how he has the strength to restore the cosmic balance between engine and cargo. And he's a destruction machine and 18 wheels of awesome. And yeah, I mean, it just, again, leaning into this idea that the world is his highway, and Miguel has become this incredible superhero. But as he transforms back into Miguel, he's sort of brought back to reality, and he realizes that he wasn't in a junkyard after all. He was at a used car dealership, and all those cars that he kind of destroyed, you know, just like a monster truck would, you know, drive over cars at a monster truck rally or whatever. He's kind of done the same thing and messed up all these cars at this used car lot. And he's thinking to himself as he comes back to Miguel and back to himself, and the phone is laying next to him. "Wow, Superman, does it feel that good every time you're a hero?" And as he's sitting there kind of recovering, there's a bunch of lights and sirens and a voice over a loudspeaker saying, "Don't send off any more bombs or whatever the hell you did. Please come out peacefully." And Miguel realizes, "Oh man, I might be in deep trouble." So he grabs the phone. He starts running out the back of the car dealership. And the police can't really see him because of all the wreckage and whatnot. And as he runs off, he gets to the street. All of a sudden, the Mayo Madness food truck shows up. And he's like, "Oh, Uncle Brand, I need help. Great, I'm glad you're here." And the voice from behind the wheel says, "Yo, hop in, loser. You're welcome." And it's not Brand at all. In fact, it's Summer. And Miguel's like confused, like, "Wait, what are you doing? Where are you going? Do you even have a license? How did you convince my uncle to give you his truck?" And she's like, "I stole it, dummy. And you want to know where we're going? We're getting the hell out of this town. That's where we're going. Or at least I am. And what did you do anyway? Why were the police chasing you? And what's that thing in your lap?" And as she says that thing in his lap, the phone, the rotary phone, starts ringing. And Miguel's like, "Uh-oh, what do I do?" And she says, "I don't know, answer it." And Miguel's like, "But I don't, I'm not." And so he answers it. And again, he hears that same voice on the other end of the line saying, "Greetings, Miguel. We've spoken before." Miguel's like, "Yeah, who are you?" And the voice says, "I'm the operator, calling you from a place called the Heroverse, and I need your help. The device you're holding is extremely dangerous. I need you to protect it. The agents of the Thunderbolt Club will go to any lengths to get their hand on it, even if it means your death." And we get the blurb, next issue, Miguel screws everything up, as you might expect a young kid to do, who's thrust into a new situation where he's in over his head and, you know, doesn't have a lot of life experiences or what have you. And yeah, not always capable of making the best choices. So it's just a fun book. It's really fun. Sam Humphries is the perfect writer for this. It's well paced. The dialogue is believable and accurate, even for, you know, the younger characters here. It's filled with a
a nice sense of adventure and mystery. And despite the destruction of some used cars, it is a pretty light-hearted feel, you know. Miguel's uncle serves as kind of the role of the establishment, you know, the older generation who just doesn't understand, and, you know, authority figure. And Miguel's certainly at the age of rebellion, and so is Summer as well. She's a good example of that. The love of heroes and heroism that Miguel has is also very much in keeping with kind of the tone and classic feel of the DC universe. Dial H for Heroes is a very classic DC universe property that's kind of filled with that sort of lightheartedness and charm and hope. And you can get quirky and funny with the heroes that you create, like Monster Truck, yeah. And again, the artwork from Joe Quinones it's just tone perfect. And the fact that he's able to change up his style from a little bit more cartoony, clean style, that's very bright and fun with primary colors, to the style that we get here that's very 90s inspired. I mean, that is just amazing work. Just incredible by Joe Quinones. So I absolutely love everything about this series. I don't think enough people read it or gave it credit for just how fun it is, and lighthearted it is. And it's a great, great story. I highly recommend it from Sam Humphries and Joe Quinones. And much like Damage, I hope that we get more at some point. So do yourself a favor, pick up the trade, pick up the single issues, give it a try. I'm not sure if it's available digitally on the DC Universe Infinite app or not, but it's definitely worth a read, and it's a lot of fun. If you like sort of the young hero feel of like Shazam or old school Legion of Superheroes and that kind of thing, it very much leans into that sort of tone and feel. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the spotlight on these three issues. Want to thank you for joining us as always. Got some more episodes coming up tomorrow from the Thanos Reading Order, so be sure and check that out. On Sunday, we've got the Bad Idea takeover of the Comic Source podcast. We're going to be flashing back to a conversation we had last year with the powers that be at Bad Idea, letting you know what to expect coming later this year. Quick recap of all the different series and whatnot. So as always, like I said, we appreciate the support and appreciate you listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.